Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFollette, professor of philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this morning is Gail Stenstad, also from the Department of Philosophy at ETSU, and our topic is Buddhism. Gail, glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Could you begin by giving just a brief synopsis of what you take Buddhism to be, and then we can look at the elements of what you say in the rest of the program?
Well, it's always hard to say one quick thing about something as large and old as Buddhism, but maybe we could try it this way. If we said Buddhism is a non-theistic religious tradition which aims to reduce suffering and increase joy through waking people up to a more realistic way of being, with a big emphasis on experience rather than dogma and on everyday practice.
Well, a lot packed into that. Yeah. Now let's begin with the first one, though, because that's going to surprise many people. I mean, when most people think about religions, they think that a religion has to be theistic. And you begin by saying it's a non-theistic religion. So could you explain that a bit?
Well, that generally surprises my students in the Survey of World Religions class here on campus, because, of course, in our culture, the dominant religious traditions, you just pretty much grow up thinking religion is how you worship God. And so now here we have a major world religion, which that's not a factor. No gods, no deities. Even in some of the versions of Buddhism, like Tibetan traditions, where they talk about deities, they're not really a deity in the sense in which we mean that. They're more of a strategy for certain kinds of practice. So Buddhism is a religion in sharing some of the same fundamental questions about truth and reality and what's best, how to live, and so forth, but does it in a way which does not require or call for the worship of a deity.
Okay, and so it would never occur to an ordinary Buddhist to assume that there's something missing from their religion.
No, not at all.
All right. Now, you mentioned a little bit about it being one of the major world religions. It certainly shows up in a number of different cultures. Does Buddhism differ from culture to culture, and is that considered an advantage or a disadvantage?
Well, there are some core ideas that all Buddhists share, but as Buddhism traveled from its origins in India, then on into Southeast Asia, China, Korea, Japan, and then now into the West, one thing that Buddhism has always actually deliberately done is sort of meld with underlying cultural values and assumptions, giving them a Buddhist flavor, also giving Buddhism the flavor of the local culture.
And that's not seen as in any way a problem for the Buddhist understanding.
No, in fact, there's a Buddhist concept that actually, right up front, aims at that sort of thing. The concept is it's a Sanskrit word called upaya, and you could sort of bring that into English as compassionate means. The idea that whatever it takes to help people enhance the joy in their lives, give deep meaning, reduce the amount of suffering, should be used. It's a matter of strategy. Now, I know that can sound awfully open-ended, so we're going to have to talk about ideas that sort of narrow it down within a ballpark, too. But just an example of how wide-ranging this idea of differing compassionate means to help people can be. I recently read an old Buddhist text that mentioned the possibility of that the Buddha had taught 84,000 different means to enlightenment. And then this particular text was going to propose the 84,001st means.
Wow. Okay. In your original description, too, you said that one of the central aims was to reduce suffering and to increase joy. Could you say a little bit more about what that means and how it is that Buddhism sees itself as achieving both of those ends?
Well, the origin of that concern had to do with the life of the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni or Gautama, who led a very sheltered life until he got to be in his late 20s, and through various things that happened in his life story, was sort of slapped in the face directly and immediately with really graphic examples of suffering: sickness, old age, decrepitude, leprosy, corpses lying rotting in ditches, and so forth. And was so moved, empathetically, by this suffering, that became his overriding concern. What can we do about this? What can we do about this, not by concocting some sort of pie-in-the-sky solution, but realistically now, on Earth, here, as human beings, what can we do to help ourselves and help each other to somehow moderate the impact of this suffering, reduce it if possible, and in any case, meaningfully increase the joy in our lives.
What do they say? How are those things to be achieved?
For the kinds of suffering that we can't just avoid, for instance, we're all going to die, right? We can change our attitudes in certain ways. And of course, it's not just a matter of willing a change in attitude. The idea that a Buddhist would more so have would be to gain a different kind of way of experiencing who and what we are so that we don't tend to grasp and cling and unnecessarily create suffering for ourselves.
Could you say more about that? How is it that we would unnecessarily create suffering? What sorts of things might we do?
Well, one of the central things would be to take for granted something we in the West usually take for granted, namely our individual self, that we are some kind of isolated, individualistic unit that stands or falls alone in this world, more or less. I mean, ultimately, you know, like existentialism would be a classic Western example of that sort of perspective. The Buddhist idea is that our Buddha nature, or the way we actually are, and not just us, but plants, animals, other anything else too, for that matter, is intrinsically relational, connected, not isolated. In fact, the relational idea is pushed to such an extent, both conceptually and experientially, that the flip side is very often described as saying that the individual self-existing unit, whether it's a person or anything else, is empty. Now, it doesn't mean unreal, doesn't mean we don't exist, it doesn't mean by any means that we're valueless. What it means is that that's an empty idea. That kind of isolationist, individualistic approach is completely an empty idea because it's just not the way things are.
And let me ask you this. What other examples of the sort of changed attitude be? One, if we assume that we're going to live forever, then that can lead to suffering. If we assume that throughout our lives we're always going to be healthy, we're not going to be sick, that can lead to suffering, undue suffering. If we assume that our lives are always going to go exactly as we planned, that can lead to suffering because we are going to die, we are going to get sick, and things are not always going to go to plan as we planned.
Yeah, or another example would be we assume that somehow I am suffering alone, that I have brought this on myself alone, and I've got to deal with it alone. And, you know, anything that emphasizes that also makes a person very defensive. I've got to defend this unitary self from attack. The self is always under attack. Psychologically, I think that's more of a pervasive attitude here in the West than we'd like to admit sometimes.
Okay, could you say a little bit more about that? The idea of feeling under attack and what Buddhism would say about it?
In Buddhism, there's nothing to be, strictly speaking, there's nothing to be attacked.
All right.
And of course, if you just take that as a concept, it can almost sound kind of absurd, you know, especially coming from our more traditional, you know, way of thinking about things. So that's why in Buddhism it's more emphasized that you experience yourself that way. It's not so much a matter of belief or dogma or accepting a concept as to cultivate experiences through various forms of meditation and so forth that we could talk about that lead a person to realize at a gut level that who I am or what I am is not, as Alan Watts used to say, an ego inside a bag of skin, but is a lot more broad than that.
Okay, you mentioned the term meditation. I know also another term that Buddhists tend to use, they talk about reaching enlightenment. What is this notion of enlightenment, and what role, if any, does meditation play in achieving it?
Enlightenment is not just a matter of acquiring a certain set of facts or understanding or knowledge as much as it is sort of waking up to a different way of experiencing things. Some of the old words in Sanskrit and so forth had a lot more to do with waking up, becoming alert, experiencing something rather than understanding something. And so meditation practices aren't so much for gaining knowledge as they are a matter of focusing on one's self in such a way as to shift the experience of what that self is.
Okay. Does enlightenment then come in all at once, or is it gradual?
Now, there's one of those differences you find in different schools of Buddhism. For example, in just Zen, which is just one form of Buddhism, there's the Rinzai school that says sudden enlightenment, flash of awakening, and then, of course, it can be deepened. And then there's the Soto school, which teaches, well, just sit, and experience, and gradually you'll understand, and this shifting will happen.
Okay.
So that's a difference you'd find.
And again, going back to the earlier thing, that's a sort of difference that Buddhists themselves would consider quite normal.
Right. I mean, in the long haul, sudden awakening, gradual awakening, as long as this awakening happens and it makes a meaningful difference in somebody's life, it doesn't matter.
Now, if you were going to describe, I mean, again, most of the people listening to the show are more familiar with Western religions. They have a sense of what some of the key ideas or of the religion would be. What would some of the key ideas of Buddhism be? I mean, you've obviously suggested a number of them so far, but maybe you can elaborate on them or add to them somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Of course, the idea that the self, our self, and the selves of plants and animals and everything else are relational, of course, is central. That's part of a bigger idea that I'd call Buddha nature. Except for a few of the very early forms of Buddhism, most of the later developments in Buddhism talked about not just one Buddha, Gautama, the historical Buddha, but everybody potentially being Buddha, because if we just knew it, we're already characterized by Buddha nature. Other words that are used for that, naturalness, enlightened existence. And I think there are three key features of Buddha nature. This is how I teach it in the intro to religion class anyway, to say that we are characterized by relationality. And we've talked a little bit about that. That this relationality is so important that the isolated, separate ego self is actually an empty idea. And then another thing that goes with that is the idea that we always change. Everything always changes. And so to hang on to things as they are and resist changing also is to fly in the face of reality and create undue suffering.
Okay, so that would be one of the examples of what enlightenment would bring, is a recognition that change is inevitable,
mm-hmm.
and if we are wanting an existence that doesn't change, then we're setting ourselves up for unnecessary suffering.
Yeah, and we could maybe clarify that a little bit more by connecting it with one of the other two ideas, namely emptiness. The idea of a self, of anything, in fact, that doesn't change is to cling to something empty. Clinging to keeping things the way they are is to cling to an empty idea, because things change.
Let's pause just for a moment for the benefit of anyone who may have tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest this morning is Gail Stenstad from the Department of Philosophy at ETSU, and we're discussing Buddhism. Was there anything else you wanted to add on the basic ideas before we move on and talk a little bit about the practice of Buddhism?
The relationality and the changing characteristics of self. One of the words that's often used to name both of those together is to talk about naturalness. I mean, sometimes you'll see in text the word suchness, which probably doesn't click much with most Westerners, but if we talk about naturalness, it does. Buddhism doesn't want to present these ideas as any kind of fancy esoteric experience, but just to say, okay, by the nature of things, this is the way things are, and if we can experience things that way, rather than through some kind of grid that teaches us to see ourselves as isolated competitors for a few goods in this world, that we'll be better off.
Now, a lot of what we talked about are certain kinds of ideas. The idea that you become enlightened, the way in which it reveals to you or helps you understand our relationality, the idea of emptiness. Now, normally, though, when we think about religions, there are also certain practices. And in fact, we can even divide practices maybe into rituals, mm-hmm. what are thought of as rituals, as well as practices that participants are thought to do. Are there rituals in Buddhism as we might think of them in the West?
That varies quite a bit. In some of the forms of Buddhism, one thinks maybe of Tibetan Buddhism, first of all. There are quite a few rituals involved. It's more of a devotional form of Buddhism. A lot of the strategies that are used, I think I even mentioned, there's some talk even of deities, although it's not the same as we think of them in the West. Existing, you know, supernatural beings or something like that. So you have some very ritualistic forms of Buddhism. And then you have other forms in which ritual is minimized or almost non-existent.
Okay.
All forms of Buddhism, however, have some emphasis on forms of meditation, on ways of sort of stilling the conceptual chatter in one's mind, focusing on things in such a way as to cultivate this direct experience of relationality and changingness and so forth that we've been talking about.
Now, does this recognition of relationality make a difference in how the Buddhist is supposed to behave, how they're supposed to relate to each other, to the society?
Well, we've already talked about impact on one's own attitude, you know, reducing one's own suffering. But also the idea is that a Buddhist would be interested in other people. And if we really are related to others, humans, animals, plants, this would be seen to naturally motivate a compassionate attitude. I mean, think of that word compassion, literally, feeling with others, empathizing with others, their joys and their sorrows, in a really deep and heartfelt way. If that feeling is genuine, it would have to motivate action. And this is how Buddhists have traditionally for centuries understood it, that a Buddhist who is interested in reducing his or her own suffering only would not really be much of a Buddhist. They would just naturally, through the experience of their own awakening to the way things are, they would want to help other people out.
Now, let me try this and see if it works. I'm trying to see if I understand this idea of compassion and the way it arises from enlightenment. In the West, when people think about moral obligations, for example, the obligation to care for one another, it's often thought of as some kind of rule outside of us.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be a good Christian, if you're going to be a good Jew, then what you need to do is you need to care for people. And again, the idea is it's something external to us telling us that's what we ought to do. As I understand, though, what goes on in enlightenment is the Buddhist comes to see that the other person, including the person in need, is not really wholly other, but somehow that we are deeply related. And so therefore the assumption is that you will help the other person in need, not because of some rule telling you to do it, but because it springs from your understanding of who you are, your place in the world, your relationship to others.
Right. I mean, one thing for sure in Buddhism, there's no lawgiver and there's no judge. You're exactly right that the motivation comes from the experience that the person themselves has. Now, there are traditionally in Buddhism certain what are called precepts for action, five traditional precepts that are typical things like you don't want to harm other people, you don't want to lie to them, sexual misconduct, abusing substances, and so forth. But those are not understood as laws or rules, but more as sort of guidelines that if a person is really being motivated through compassion and mindfulness, you almost wouldn't need the precepts because that's just the way you would want to be.
And so that's why you don't need a lawgiver as well. The idea of a lawgiver is someone to punish you if you don't do it.
Right.
And the assumption is if you've had the appropriate experiences and the appropriate understanding that you'll do it automatically.
Right. And
the idea of someone enforcing it's just unnecessary.
Right, and there will be consequences because the often misunderstood idea of karma, for example, in its basic and most simple and obvious form is that actions have consequences. If you treat people badly, this will have an impact on you. And there's no supernatural enforcer in karma either, of any kind. Just happens.
Could you say a little bit more about this concept of karma and there being consequences to treating other people badly?
Well, the word karma actually simply means just action, and it has to do with the idea that actions have consequences. And the consequences may be obvious. For instance, you treat someone rudely, they're going to probably not treat you very well either. Or there can be other, you know, for instance, here's another obvious example, sexual misconduct. If someone is behaving promiscuously in a really stupid way in our society, you know, even aside from religious strictures of Buddhist or whatever kind, in the era of AIDS and other such transmitted diseases, it's not too hard to see how those kinds of actions could have some really ugly consequences. Now, traditional Buddhism also talks about that extending across lifetimes and so forth. But one doesn't need to get into that to see the idea that without any lawgiver, without anybody to enforce the rules, so to speak, one's own actions are going to impact on them.
And so one of the things that you would gain by enlightenment is the awareness of the fact that your actions have consequences. I mean, if you weren't aware of it before, that would presumably come from...
Well, yeah, and it's also reinforced by this idea of relationality. I mean, that sort of gives a kind of an understanding of the means by which that the consequences come around.
Okay. We're related not only to each other, but to our environments and ways, and whatever we do has effects on others in our environment. What happens in our environment has effects on us.
Right, and that's probably one of the reasons why a lot of contemporary Buddhists are very concerned about ecological issues, for example.
Well, in fact, let's pursue that a bit. I mean, when people think about Buddhism, they think of Buddhism primarily in the East, India and the Far East. But it's clear that Buddhism is becoming increasingly prominent in the West. What are some of the ideas that have had a special appeal in the West? I mean, I think you just mentioned one.
I think the relationality fits very well with a lot of people's concern that they already may have had with the damage that we're doing to our environment. We may well be damaging the worldwide ecosystem to such extent that we can't even sustain our own lives. Buddhism would take that beyond a kind of a limited self-interest idea to say, okay, if myself is relational to the whole earth ultimately, then my self-interest has become very much broadened from what it might have been. And that would provide a sort of an additional rationale or motivation for a Buddhist to do what he or she could to moderate their negative impact on the environment.
I mean, are Buddhists in the West, in fact, fairly heavily involved in the environmental movement?
Not without exception, but yeah, I'd say generally. I mean, one of the more interesting books that's come out recently is an anthology called Dharma Gaya, which emphasizes that theme throughout. And there are people coming from many different traditions and schools within Buddhism that are all sharing that same concern.
Okay. Now, is that, obviously it's not wholly unique, but is it at least somewhat unique in the Western?
The ecological emphasis has been shared, in fact, a lot with Buddhists in India, Ceylon, and other places, too. So maybe that's not so unique to the West, although it's maybe been getting a heavier emphasis. There's a couple other features of Buddhism in the West that are a little more unique. One is that Buddhism, with many of the other world religions, has been traditionally rather patriarchal. Even though there have been some important Buddhist thinkers like Dogen and Shinran in 13th century Japan who said that that should not be the case, nevertheless it was the case historically and factually. Whereas in Buddhism in Europe and North America, there have been in the last couple of decades some very well-regarded teachers holding positions they would never have held in traditional Asian Buddhism.
Okay.
So that's a kind of unique feature.
So that would go back to one of the things you mentioned earlier on, upaya, I'm not sure how you pronounce
upaya,
it.
Upaya, yeah.
That you adapt the circumstances. Now, has there been some reverberation back to the more Eastern practice of Buddhism? For example, are they now more willing to accept women teachers than they might have been previously?
To some extent, that's been happening. Now, to what extent that's a result of changes in the West, I'm not so sure. I haven't actually thought about it in that way, frankly. I can mainly more on that just speak to what's going on in North America, primarily.
Well, what other ideas are sort of unique? Or perhaps unique is the wrong word. At least the emphasis is slightly different in the West.
Well, I think this relates a little bit to the women teachers thing. In most Asian countries, whether it's Ceylon or Burma or Thailand or Japan, there's traditionally been quite a division between monastic practice of Buddhism and lay Buddhism, where the people mainly doing the meditation practices, for example, will be monks and nuns living in a monastery, and then the rest of the people will come to the temple for weddings or funerals or whatever and contribute to the support of the practice of the monks and the nuns. So there's been quite a distinction. When Buddhism comes into North America and Europe, well, most people aren't going to want to go off and be monks and nuns, So a big change has been now that a Buddhism where everybody practices, where meditation isn't just for the monks and nuns, for the people, you know, that can devote their entire life to that, more structured practice, but for everybody. So a big emphasis then on day-to-day, everyday practice, people learning to meditate, maybe going to a retreat or something where there's a focus on that, but then coming back and incorporating this into their family life. So that's been one of the emphasis. And I think maybe that's another reason why women are more involved.
Okay.
Too.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you were going to speculate, what's been the impact of this change? I suppose you could say the priesthood of the ordinary believer, that mm-hmm. that everybody is a monk, everyone's a...
In a sense. I mean, there are still teachers, right, to help people along in their practice and so forth. But the idea that you don't have to go off and be a monk to do this is crucial. I mean, and then, of course, that goes with another phrase that's become current probably just in the last 10 years or so is engaged Buddhism, which is to take the non-monasticism, the involvement of both men and women, the ecological emphasis and so forth, and maybe other political concerns too that would grow from a compassionate way of thinking, you know, maybe animal issues or something like that, and say, okay, let's get together and get involved grassroots and see what we can do to bring these changes.
Okay. If you were going to sort of sum up for the listener in the last minute what you see as the core ideas, what you'd like them to take away from this interview, what would it be?
Well, it's hard to select. That you can have a meaningful, powerful religion without a god would be something to remember about Buddhism. And that there are other ways of being a person, being a self, that can also give a lot of meaning to people's lives other than the competitive, individualistic mode.
Well, thank you very much for appearing on the show.
You're welcome.
I've been talking today with Gail Stinstad from the Department of Philosophy. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.